My name is Dan Nadel. I am a publisher of Picture Box and co-editor of Comics and Comics, as well as the author of Art in Time. To my left is Evan Dorgan, cartoonist extraordinaire, Milk and Cheese, and many, many other comics, including Dork.
What's extraordinaire mean? Is that like French for middling?
It means you've been making extraordinary comics for years.
You're nice, Dan.
Well, you know, when I was a little toddler.
No. I'm old
that's
now.
That's less
too.
Nice. And then to Evan's left is G. Heer, comics historian and writer, and co-editor of the Walton Cizik series, among many other projects. And at the bottom.
The bottom?
At the bottom.
Yeah,
At the bottom, when I'm looking down,
on internet crowd.
Is that to the far left is Seth, cartoonist and also
that's extraordinary, yeah,
and designer of the Complete Peanuts as well as the John Stanley Library. And today we are talking about packaging and editing and conceptualizing comic reprints. Something I've been involved with, and Seth, of course, and Evan has been a vocal commenter.
I'm a customer. I'm representing the fan.
Evan represents the fan and also the practitioner looking for his history.
That's true. Thanks for that.
That's the first thing I wanted to talk about, actually. This is something following on an essay, a wonderful essay about Chris Ware that G wrote that's just been published. You've talked a lot about, and I think this is very important, about kind of contemporary cartoonists inventing their history, finding a lineage outside of the established canon, and not just writing about it like the filmmakers in the 60s did or in the 70s did, but actually archiving it, preserving it, both as collectors and then packaging it and publishing it as editors and designers. So I wanted to start with Seth, talking about sort of how you came to want to not just, you know, collect this stuff, but create a lineage for yourself, and sort of as an extension of that, you're sort of reinventing the history of comics broadly by what you're focusing on. So maybe you could talk a little bit. And as a side note, before you talk, I've thought many, many times. About your list in the Comics Journal Top 100 comics of all time. Do you remember that?
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
Regretted I wrote that.
Oh, you shouldn't, because that list helped me write Art Out of Time.
Oh, really? That's
so you should wait. So you should regret it.
Yeah.
But I thought that list must either it's only been influential on me, but I bet it's been influential on a lot of people. So I wondered if you could start talking a little bit about that.
Well, I think the interesting thing about being a cartoonist as opposed to being, say, a painter or other endeavors in the more traditional arts is that you didn't have easy access to your own history. I know that when I came up in the 80s, the fan culture that had preceded me had started to reclaim cartoonists from the past and bring their works out, but it was really from the perspective of the fan nostalgists of the 60s and 70s. And most of that work that they were bringing back was along the lines of Flash Gordon or Buck Rogers or Tarzan, these sort of things that reflected the adventure genres they grew up with and that they deeply loved and were deeply nostalgic for. And that wasn't the stuff that really spoke to me as a cartoonist. I realized pretty early on that I had to seek out my own ancestors, as was mentioned. At that point, I wouldn't have realized that's what I was doing. I just knew that I was interested in old cartooning, and it's the interest is natural you'd have in your own medium. You'd want to look back. There was a couple of books that you could use as reference books. There was Maurice Horn's Encyclopedia of Comics, which later turned out to be filled with inaccuracies. But I didn't know that at the time. But basically, what that meant was you had to go out and find the material, and that's where I think the real connection between cartoonists and collecting comes from. It's a strong point that I think is often brought up that cartoonists are collectors because they come out of the comic book world, which is a world of collectors, but I don't think that's strictly true. I think they're mostly collectors because they have to collect the material they need to study. They can't just go out and buy books of it, at least not until fairly recently. Yeah. So that meant like going out and actually like haunting the primary sources. You'd have to go to like the dreaded humor section of bookstores. You'd have to like look in paper shows, go to like Goodwills and any kind of like antique stores and really just dig around. And, you know, you have your initial burst of where you find, like, you know, the common stuff, and then you start winnowing down towards what appealed to you the most. I mean, for myself, I might have found, like, you know, the most popular New Yorker collections immediately, like the 1925 to 1950 collection, which is in every bookstore. And then, you know, that, and then you'd say, like, oh, this guy's great in here, this Peter Arno, for example. Okay. Then you'd say, like, oh, well, with some research you discover, oh, he seems to have, like, maybe 20 books. And it would take you, like, 20 years to find them in those days. But so much of that process of finding the work was about creating your own pantheon and your own lineage. I remember once William de Kooning, I think, was asked who influenced him. I often quote this because it's a line that boggled me when he first said it. They asked him who influenced him, and he said, what painters from the past influenced you? And he said, painters from the past don't influence me. I influence them. And I remember thinking, what an asshole. But, you know, as time went on, I came to understand what that quote really meant. It's like his work recontextualized those artists from the past. And that's so much of what Finding Ancestors is about in cartooning. You look back at works that existed before you, you make a personal connection to them. And by bringing them into the world of the present, you recontextualize them. You put them in a new context. I mean, that's really what's happened with Frank King through the Gasoline Alley collections that Jeet and Chris Ware have done. It's added an entire new dimension to what that work was about. Even Peanuts, I think, as popular as Peanuts is, the recollecting of it has recontextualized it. It's like, clearly Peanuts in the last generation of cartoonists who love him have seen him more as a pure artist. I think up until like maybe even like the 1990s, he was seen as the most successful cartoonist, certainly the most pop culture cartoonist, but not the greatest artist working in comics. I think that's really changed. But basically, my whole point is that the desire to bring this work out again after you discover it yourself is initially you want to share it with the world. You're like, these guys are so great, whoever they are. I want other people to see them. But there is some sense of like you want to give them legitimacy too. You want, there's something sad in the world of cartooning about how quickly people's careers fade away and how quickly the important work they've done loses its context. People forget why it was even important.
Evan, you want to talk a little bit about your own process? Because you worked in it.
It's, yeah, I'm not sure how I fit in here. I mean, I'm definitely getting thoughts, but I don't feel as legitimately that I should be on this panel. From my perspective, the confusion that Seth alludes to is definitely there. I didn't have a circle of friends who liked comics or strips, and I'm one of the people who definitely, you know, to put it in, you know, plain terms, came from comic books. I grew up on the newspaper strips. I loved Peanuts. I liked what was in. I didn't like adventure strips for some reason, but I guess Marvel Comics were my adventure strips. My family didn't have. I have friends who I've grown up with now, and their parents read a lot. They had libraries. All the New Yorker collections are in there. There's Arno. There's Stieg. There's Darrow Jr. I didn't discover these until I was an adult. Pre-eBay in New York City, you could find a lot of the Arno stuff, Adams, but I started getting crazy about this stuff. But when I worked in I'd have to just say for me, it was when I was working for Jim Haley's Universe, I didn't know about a lot of what was going on in the comics world. He introduced me to Vintage Eisner, which is still my favorite period, not to get on a tangent, which is actually strips. But he introduced me to things like Abby and Slats and these like things that I never thought I would like. I am now pretty much most of the things that I purchase and read are strip reprints. I'm sort of nuts about them. None of this information was there for me. As a kid, I dreamed of going to Queens, which is only a few boroughs over from where I lived in Brooklyn, one borough over, to go to a store called Little Nemo's, which was a famous comic shop that advertised in convention booklets in the 70s. If you basically went back in time and had $200 in your pocket, you could walk out with a stack of original comic art by Masters, this thick. This was just somebody, there were very few people who loved this stuff and wanted to bring it out there. And you'd read the books that were coming out in the 70s and 80s, and there's like about six names that keep popping up. And it's funny to turn out a lot of them held this stuff, in my opinion, close to the heart, and you hear stories about them. They didn't seem to want to share it.
Mm. Yeah.
That's a really weird thing that I'm learning. You know, you grow up and you think Stan and Jack were pals, and everybody got along great, and fans love the stuff and want to share it. And what's amazing is the sharing of this material. For me, it's a bonanza. As a reader, someone who's become crazy about strips in the last 15, 20 years, to see all this material come up. Now, my problem is I can't keep up with it. I don't know who can, who doesn't have connections to the industry.
Yeah.
Gasoline Alley was a revelation for me. That was a strip that I avoided like the plague growing up. I'm even enjoying some stuff I'm seeing from my day and age in that strip. Mm-hmm. Not as much as King's, but I've become such a Frank King fanboy. My daughter, who is 5, loves the strip now. I don't know where I'm going with this, but I find the work so much richer than a lot of the comic books, which I still love. There's something about getting a big, thick bundle of this. It's not just pop culture. To me, it's culture. Gasoline Alley is so about his world and of raising a child. My child was the same age. My daughter was 1 year old when I got that first book. And when Skeezix turns 1 at the end of the book, and I had spent this time with, I literally started crying. I just found it incredibly moving. I read it cover to cover again. She knows because I was like, where is volume 4? I was going crazy. And to me, it's as if newspaper comics are back because there's always a new thing to explore. There's always a new thing to learn about. Not just from a craft point of view. I'm just, how important these books were culturally is lost. I mean, lots of people have seen photos of the Lulu Kleenex. You could not imagine how important these books were and how they influenced culture, how culture influenced them. For me, this not just having the strips, but the material that is being, as it's being designed and appreciated, and as it's being written about, it's set a new standard. The Peanuts books and the Walton Skeezix books have set such a standard for these reprints that anybody who does not live up to that now is like, gets rocks thrown at them. If you were to do a Foxy Grandpa collection and you did not write everything you could find about Foxy Grandpa, people would be like, this is a real disappointment. They really dropped the ball hit. But it's fantastic to be able to have a library that literally is a reference library as well, because you could not find this material. You couldn't even find the material on Kirby when I was growing up as a kid.
It's true.
I actually want to take up something both of you have talked about, which is the sort of relationship between contemporary cartoonist and like this historical stuff, because I think that's a very important point. And I'll illustrate it maybe with a story about, like, in researching the Gasoline Alley strips, which Frank King did in the 20s and 30s, and then Chris Ware and I are doing these books, and we went down to St. Louis, where Frank King's granddaughter lives. And so we were, you know, we spent a couple of weekends every few years going in her basement. She's very kind, obviously, to put up with us. And we're going through, like, she's a pack rat, which is we're grateful for. And we go through all the papers. And the last time I was down there, I was, like, going through, like, this correspondence that Frank King had with the syndicate and with other people. And I saw this letter from a newspaper editor in Omaha, Nebraska, complaining about, you know, saying, I love Frank King's Gasoline Alley. It's a great comic strip, but why are you putting advertisement in it? This was a period in 1950 where they tried to put an ad for television within the comic strip. And the letter was signed Frederick Ware. Now, I happen to know that Chris Ware, you know, comes from Nebraska, and his grandfather was a newspaper editor. So I went into the other room where Chris was doing his own research and scanning, and I said, Chris, is this what I think it is? And yes, so this is a letter from Chris Ware's granddad to Frank King. And the reason it's sort of interesting is that if you think about it, it makes perfect sense that Chris was kind of raised partially by his grandparents. They loved these comic strips. They sort of, and his mom was a Gasoline Alley fan as well. And, you know, like so Chris, when he grew up, it was kind of natural that he would find an affinity with this material. And so it's almost like a bad movie script. Like you go to the basement and you find like Rosebud or whatever, right? But having said that, I mean, and it also ties in very interestingly thematically with Chris's own work in Jimmy Corrigan and his current Rusty Brown work, which is all about generational change and the way that people from the past influence what's going on now. And as well as Seth's own work in his first graphic novel, If It's a Good Life, If You Don't Weaken, which is about a cartoonist researching the history of comics. So in some ways, I think all this ongoing search for comics is both about the past, but it's also about what cartoonists are doing in the present. And I think that's very important. That's one reason why it's very interesting.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think that a lot of the talk about recontextualizing the work is that that is kind of the point of it.
Yeah.
Is that it's not just a matter of getting another volume of Little Orphan Annie in.
Yeah.
It's like reclaiming the work.
Yeah.
And sort of giving it a context that people can view it, not just in its own time context, but how it is part of the world of cartooning of today.
Yeah.
To restore a kind of seriousness to the work, not to ruin the fun of it.
Yeah.
There's some sense of, by making things too serious, by tying it to ourselves, we're ruining the fun of this work. But I think that it is important to see that these people produce large bodies of work that have some sort of coherent meaning too.
Yeah.
It was too easy for this stuff to get just stuck in the nostalgia category. That it falls into the category of old B-movies or radio mm-hmm. shows or things that are brought up because primarily they appealed as nostalgia to a previous generation. Certainly it doesn't apply to all the work that was done. There was mm-hmm. The history of cartooning, any kind of popular medium, is filled with a lot of dross. But there is a great amount of gold in there, too, that's been, I think, needs to be brought forward and needs to be packaged in a way that sort of immediately gives the viewer or the purchaser an idea of what's being transmitted about the work. I know that when I designed the Peanuts books, that was my main interest, was to present Peanuts in what I felt was a respectful manner so that the work was allowed to speak for itself in a way that I always felt it hadn't really been able to. They were always packaged as very poppy kind of pop culture ephemera.
Those paperbacks that everyone has 40 of.
Yeah.
They're great when you're a kid.
Yeah,
but when
exactly.
you get old, there is no context. In fact, I could never figure out, was there ever a volume one of any of them?
Because no, I know. It was always
reprints, they always reprinted old books, but I've never found the actual ground zero of what they came from. They said, you're a good man, Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
You cash the check, Kirk Charlie Brown reprints.
Yeah.
I've never seen the original paperback,
I think that's where I learned the meaning of the word abridged.
Real quick, though, what I love as a cartoonist and as a reader and as a fan, I'm not embarrassed of the word fan, even if I'm embarrassed by, my work is about the embarrassment of fandom aspect of it, is that context is very important to me, that the library... My library these days is actually a library. It is not just a collection. And I'm not knocking with NBM or Fantagraphics. I mean, a lot of these people, they're recontextualizing their recontext.
Yeah, it's been a process. It's
and
been a process for
replacing these
years.
Books and being able to chart a viable history mm-hmm. of certain cartoonists who you've always heard about or you've pieced together, to be able to place McManus, to place Jack Kent, mm-hmm. a pretty forgotten guy who I think is mm-hmm. amazing.
Yeah,
to hunt his stuff down was very difficult. It took me a while to... I was talking to Mark Newgarden about it, that there was just a one book of Kingaroo, and to see that pop up in previews was a small dream. And to be able to place some of these 50s cartoonists who are fans of some of the 30s and 20s is fascinating to Kent was a real fan.
Yeah.
Some cartoonists came out of the newspapers doing the sports or doing the reportage. He was a guy who read comics, sent fan letters, like a modern-day fan that you think of, learned from some of these people, and put that into his comics. And then to see people who read Kent that we, who knows? I love being able to see from the very beginning, literally at this point, what's being reprinted. I mean, the idea that Fantagraphics is going to be putting out the Teeny Weenies... A strip. I know it sounds funny. It's a beautifully drawn
story strip.
For a time, I believe it was in strip form, and I could not afford any tear sheets, any Sundays from this. And my daughter would love this, and my wife and I, we like Johnny Gruhl style. And there's a Johnny Gruhl book coming out of his strip.
Yeah.
How do you get these things? I hope this lasts.
Yeah.
I hope that the market isn't gonna. I don't know how it's lasted this many years to look through some of my strip reprints. Recently, while I was doing something, and to see that this has been going on for a number of years now, it feels like it's just been two or 3 years
yeah.
that Peanuts and all these books have been coming out. it's an amazing golden age right now, not just in strip reprints. So some people seem to realize it, and I hope we don't lose it, because not many industries. Film, obviously, is a medium that you can do that with, but you know, radio is another one where you are in a vintage store with old. If you care for that, you're going to conventions in New Jersey with 100-year-old guys in wheelchairs, and a few young people going, "I've got blood in my system. We can talk later about Lum and Abner or something." You know, it's really weird. Also, piecing the puzzle together of comics to radio to newspapers to film is fascinating, and the pulps for me coming to it fairly late. It's a piece that's been missing for a long time in my readership.
I want to ask a little bit more about the repackaging and the aesthetics of it, because Evan,
I'm out.
No. I mean, because Seth obviously is done the John Stanley books and Peanuts. But there's been a fair amount of debate online, and I suppose since comics writing is only online pretty much now, online, about the meaning of that, the meaning of an artist putting their work or their gloss on top of another artist's work, what the reading experience is, what these new designs signify in terms of if it becomes serious, you know, what you brought up, this dichotomy, this supposed dichotomy between serious and fun, all this sort of stuff. But I wondered, Evan, if you'd be willing to talk a little bit about sort of what your thoughts were, and then Seth, if you'd respond.
Sure.
Well, we've talked about it.
Yeah.
And I basically, I'm of two minds. Sometimes I wish the original, and this is not a knock.
No, go for it.
Sometimes I wish
go
the original
it.
Art
I can take it.
Artist was represent. No. It's not an aesthetic knock. It's just a this is where I'm coming from as a reader. Yeah. I'm not a designer. If anybody's seen my books, they know that. I wish that was a joke. It's just sad. But I love the design work, and I've heard artists complain about it from one end to the other. To me, the main thing is, if it's coming out of love and respect, I can respect the choice, even if I think aesthetically I don't agree with it. I'm kind of uptight. I want to see, initially, a John Stanley design on there, because he drew the thing. That... I do realize intellectually that that also comes from a fandom point of view, not an artistic point of view. I like the designs a hell of a lot. I think the only design that I felt overwhelmed was the Doug Wright book.
Yeah.
And the reason it hit me is because I was, in fact, talking to Dennis, the Doug Wright book was right next to the George Sprague book. Mm-hmm. And I thought that if I showed both of them to a person who didn't know comics, and I said, one of these is a fictional person, and one of these is a cartoonist, they might not be able to tell, because the drawing is very small on the... I think it's a gorgeous book, you know? But I just thought, in that case, I love the Stanley designs. My daughter loves them. She's a five-year-old, and sometimes I think that's really a great... I mean, to see another generation reading this old work, both the Frank King and she loves it.
I understand these complaints. I really do.
Yeah, but on the whole, you can tell when somebody's done a sloppy job.
Yeah.
We won't get into it, maybe.
Yeah.
But I personally think, the weird thing is, I think the level of design has been so damn strong, and that's not to be Team Comics, because I'm not on that team, that I don't have a lot of criticisms of most of it. I love what Fantagraphics has done. Dean Mullaney, a guy who a lot of people did not like in the 80s, has somehow...
Yeah,
I don't know what he did, or he took a pill or something. He's been doing fantastic work on a pretty tight schedule.
And I
obviously he's taking from... You look at Dick Tracy, that was a disaster.
Yeah. No, Dean wasn't involved with the early Dick Tracy.
I know that, but you see what IDW started there. Yeah. And they were biting off the Peanuts design. They hired a guy who was completely... not knocking Ashley Holt as an artist. He does his robots and stuff. He's not known for that. He doesn't come from that aesthetic. It was a job to him, and you can tell. And he seemed bewildered, in my opinion, I'm guessing here, and he looked at what was the best examples out there. And even if Dick Tracy was just a commercial choice, following the Peanuts and Frank King, they did a nice job on the interior information. Now he's doing the books. They look much better. The King of Roo book is wonderful.
Yeah.
It's an embarrassment of riches. I feel that if there's love going into the books, you can tell. If there's a mercenary approach, it's or just a bandwagon or a schmucky, let's knock out a lot of books, you can tell. Maybe some of you know who I'm talking about there. But
I'll stop right there, or we'll do a half hour on that.
Yeah, it's complicated. The when working on the work, designing a book of the work of another artist is a complicated negotiation. Certainly with Peanuts, when I approached the work initially, I didn't sit down and work out a laborious plan for it. It was almost like immediately, I'd been studying Peanuts for so many years, when the moment came to design the books, there was the design. It wasn't like I did five designs and picked one. It was like this was the design that came up because it was almost the design that I'd always been waiting to do. I tried to tread lightly on like putting myself into that book, but you know what? The first complaints were it's like there's too much Seth in this book, not enough Charles Schulz. My basic response to that is, and it's only gotten worse from that. Yeah. I mean, the other books are even more have even more of my stamp on them than Peanuts. My response to that is I'm not a designer like Chip Kidd. I don't work for a company to package things. In many ways, these books are they are a tribute from one cartoonist to another. And part of what I'm doing is, when we talked about recontextualizing them, a big thing that I'm trying to do is give these artists their due as artists. And that's one of the hard things cartoonists have had over the years. The cartoonists themselves wouldn't have ever used the word. Mm-hmm. Most of them were like shy about it. You see, with someone like, even like someone like Schulz, who was at the top of his game, his work hung in the Louvre. You know, he was aware, he was like very nervous about the idea of being an artist because, you know, it was a pop culture medium, and I think that they were very afraid that if you said you were an artist, someone would laugh. They really stepped back from that. But, you know, I want them to have the dignity that they were due. And for me, that comes from, you know, it does come from some kind of a weird collaboration between myself and this artist. When I'm designing those Peanuts books, I kind of feel like I'm drawing them with Schulz's hand. It's like I'm taking his drawings, I'm cutting them up, I'm building new pictures out of his drawings. I'm not actually drawing them, but those like double page spreads you'll see with like, you know, like with Snoopy's doghouse where they're empty. Yeah. Those are Schulz's drawings. I mean, I might add in a little line here if something's missing, but on some level I can see how this is perceived as sacrilege. You know, it's like playing around with the masters. But on another level, I think like the entire book inside is Charles Schulz. I'm not fiddling around with his work. With John Stanley, it's like my stamp is on those books heavily. But you know what? John Stanley's work, 90% of it was drawn by other artists.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't think he'd mind if I drew a picture of Melvin Monster on the cover.
So the Irving Tripp fans, though, are mad.
that's where the complaints come.
Yeah.
But, and I can understand these complaints. And I might feel those same complaints, too, if I didn't like the artist who was doing it. And that's the thing. You've got to put up with me to get the book, is the problem.
Well, can I...
Just out of curiosity, Seth... I mean, the one thing we've all talked about probably privately is that there's an ethical dimension to this.
Of course.
There's a dimension of the person that we're not talking about today. the idea that you can really fuck up somebody's work.
Yeah.
You can actually do a bad job. Yeah. You can present them badly. You can edit it badly. You can
make a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, and so I wonder, I mean, I think on Comics, I can't remember where, but there's the idea that I think people have thought, well, Seth is distorting the view of the work.
Yeah, for sure.
Here's the funny thing, though.
Go ahead.
Real quick, though, another way to look at it for me is, if you were really distorting that work, the Peanuts Corporation and the Schulz family would kick your ass to the curb.
Well, they're not the best guardians. Yeah.
But you know what I'm saying? I don't see Hallmark cards that look like...
Right.
Yeah. Roger Langridge drew them, or I drew them. You know, they seem to be...
Peanuts is a good example because there's been 40 years of books that I felt were rather flippantly done about Peanuts, but nobody got upset until there was one that tried to give it a serious
context. You could say people have seen a Charlie Brown cover before, really, if you think about it.
Well, I want to get on that point because this is something that really... gets me annoyed, which is the sort of criticisms that have been made about Seth's design and occasionally Chris Ray's design. There's a couple of points that need to be made, which is that we have a long tradition in comics of bad design. The tradition in comics is of schlocky design, cheap design, and nobody cared. And people only started to notice design when real artists started to put in a sensibility. And strangely enough, that's when people noticed design and started to get mad at design. So you can go to any used bookstore and find like an endless number of penis books that are badly designed or just like indifferently designed, mediocrely designed. The second point to make on that is actually that there's no such thing as neutral design. There's no neutral peanuts book that like exists out there. Any design is a choice. Mm-hmm. And those mediocre peanuts books are as designed as Seth's peanuts books. They're just designed by people who aren't as a good artist as Seth. So by making a mediocre peanuts book, you're kind of making a statement about what you think of Schultz.
Yes, that's true.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, the other point is...
fodder.
Yeah.
They're just putting stuff on the rack.
That's right,
designs. Sell this book, 60 cents. Yeah.
That's right. All those paperbacks carry a message. The other point is about the intent of the artist, which is we're all talking about dead artists. If Schultz were alive today, and there's a choice between Schultz designing a book and Seth designing a book, I would go with Schultz.
Same here.
Yeah, I think
I'd go with Schultz.
But he's not here.
Yeah, I could not have done that design if Schultz had been alive.
Yeah, yeah. So that's...
I mean, not just because he wouldn't have let me, but because I wouldn't have felt the freedom to do my own design in the same way.
Yeah,
his presence would have been more palpable.
Like would have made you self-conscious.
Well, I would have gone to him, and design, you know, if they'd asked me to do it, if he wanted someone to design the book, which is very common with Schultz, he didn't care that much about the design.
Yeah.
But if I'd gone there and he'd said, like, you know, this really does, I don't like this, and these color schemes are off, I would have been immediately like, well, then this is the wrong design. But with him gone, I was ready when I went there to present the work to the Schultz family that if it was like, you know, if I got into a conversation that was turning it into one of those old Peanuts books, I was just going to bail.
Yeah.
Because I thought there's no point in doing the designs that I think are wrong for the book. But Schultz, that would supersede it. It's his work.
Yeah, that's right. And the other point is, maybe thinking about it historically, some of those cartoonists did do design work early in their career. Like, I think Walt Kelly was involved in the design of some of those books in the 50s.
Frank King.
King was. And I think even Schultz. For the first few, Schultz did the design, and they're actually quite lovely.
They're the best ones.
Yeah, and then afterwards, other people did it. So I think that's kind of worth bearing in mind, that people who are objecting to Seth's designs aren't complaining about... they're not thinking about the books that Schultz himself designed. They're thinking about books other people designed, and often designed in a very mediocre way. And I think that, I mean, as strange as this may sound, I think that there are people who are invested in the comics being a schlocky medium. They like the fact that it's like a pulpy medium, it's cheap. I've heard people who have, I think the Dark Horse reprints of Little Lulu aren't bad. I mean, I have them all, but they're not... quite the same quality as Seth's designs. And I think that, but there are people who prefer them, and I think that they prefer them for the wrong reasons. They like them because they're cheap, and because they're bulky, there's a lot of them, and because that they think that they're like neutral. They think that these books aren't design heavy, but they are designed. They're designed, you know, to say that this is like a cheap throwaway.
I will say there is a knock about accessibility of them, that makes sense, but it's a phrase that came to my head. My daughter is currently going through them all, and the rainbow ones, and she's a little nervous when she's with the rainbow ones.
She shouldn't.
The presence of a Hartwell,
because
she knows that I'll break her in half if she ruins them.
Very few people have picked up that Schultz Library was meant for kids. Mm-hmm. Or not Schultz Library, the Stone Stanley Library.
Yeah.
And I understand that, but you know, there are lots of hardcover children's books.
Yeah,
out there.
Sure. No, I'm kidding. It's just like, I think I agree with him, because from the comics end of it, which I guess I can represent best here in a weird way, there are people who never want the industry or the medium, if they think about the medium, to get out of certain confines.
Yeah.
If they find out about this, it won't be as much fun. I'm sure it's the same way with any collectively. For me, it's interesting. I didn't think about it, though. One reason I love the Another Rainbow editions and the Russ Cochran DC editions is that I never thought of it, but they are doing, to a degree, what everyone seems to be doing now. There is interviews, and I love having that, where they're discussing the covers.
Like, over the years, to get to the point we are now.
I never realized those have been around quite some time now.
Yeah.
And those are my preferred editions of those, not just because they're big and kind of neat and smell great and look great on the shelf, but I love the interviews that John Benson has in there.
Yeah,
and I love finding out more things about the strips, because I knew nothing. Little Lulu was another one of those characters and strips where you grow up and people love the Walt Disney books. I'm like, come on, that's got to be garbage. Oh, they love Floyd Godwinson's mouse. That's garbage. He's a terrible character. And they love Little Lulu. why would anybody read Lulu at the age of 8? I wouldn't go near any of these characters. Lulu to me is still one of the best. It's just one of the best written vehicles. It's just hilarious. I could talk for an hour about that. Real quick on the penis, though. For me, what I love about it is that when I love the penis design. I have them all in the slip cases, the ones I have so far, because I want more design. They register as a really nice mix of melancholy and fun. Mm. There's a funny image in them, but there's also this really kind of Charlie Brown's, the depressing side of the strip.
Yeah.
And the thing is, cartoonists and pundits and writers have all keyed in on the surreal aspects of Schultz, the depressing ones, but the general public really hasn't.
No,
those early strips are depressing and sometimes very mean.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that the design should be what cartoonists wanted to be. I think that they work. And also there is a weird elevation, for lack of a word, when you get this package that has all this material in it. And you reappraise.
You want the package to be a jewel box around the jewel. And that's really the point of it. Schultz's work doesn't need packaging, ultimately. I mean, the work was considered great, and it survived those faucet paperbacks, and all of us grew up with them, and we probably have fond feelings for them because that's where we experienced the work, and the work shone through. But there's nothing wrong with placing it into a serious context. Yeah. Serious is the wrong word. I guess the word I want is respectful.
Reverent.
Respectful.
I also like the pairing of a cartoon. It's funny that I have reservations about it when at the same time, I remember when Tom Spurgeon had as one of his Five for Fridays, put a strip together with a designer who would do the package. And I love thinking about that. And the readers seem to love thinking about that because Chris Ware with the Crazy Cat, and I'm sorry, I'm still nervous, and with the Frank King and Seth with the projects he's designing, I would love to see more of that.
Well, there's a real synergy at work. Like, I think,
love that.
Yeah, like Frank King by himself is great. Chris Ware by himself is obviously great. But when you have Frank King plus Chris Ware, you have something more. You have it's like this connection.
It's like when the old entertainers would bring out somebody they were a big fan of. They try to get, but luckily, it's not like bringing Buster Keaton out in the 60s and he can't talk or he's drunk.
Yeah.
But it really, and it does put it in context, and it makes it, for lack of a better word, cool.
Well, I want to ask a little bit about audience because I think that's interesting. But yeah, it makes it cool. One thing that was brought up, I guess, on Comics, was so the audience for the John Stanley books. Mm-hmm. And yes, of course, I think people forget that children's books are often heavy and elaborate and hardcover.
Mm-hmm.
Toon Treasury is a wonderful book.
I
can attest to my daughter going nuts for that.
It's a
strips
collection.
I've given that to a couple of kids, and they really liked it.
She's reading strips that previously 40 to 60 year old men were clipping and going to paper shows. It's really kind of
interesting. It's a lot cuter when a little girl's
like that. Hopefully she won't be collecting barbed wire next.
The John Stanley books, one thing that people have noticed is that there is, because they are pitched at kids, there is a lack of archival material and essays. Yeah. And I wonder, Seth, if that's forthcoming, if that's going to change, or if there's another book coming down the pike that's a companion, or I buy it.
Yeah,
what
there's
do you...
been talk of that. I mean, when Tom Devlin proposed the series to begin with, he specifically wanted it to be aimed at children. and that meant we wouldn't have a lot of archival material in it. He just didn't want it to be aimed specifically at the collector's market.
Yeah.
But even from the beginning, and with these kind of plans, you can never say they will happen, but he's planned to do a bigger sort of Art of John Stanley book at some point, where you actually there get the opportunity to explore it for collectors and historians. But at first I was kind of along with most people would have been couldn't we make this more of a book with a ton of information in the front and lots of rare art? But eventually he won me over because I thought the material is so appealing. That it's guaranteed kids will like it, and you just you want a package that is just the comics. That's really nice. I can see how the collector's market that there was an initial stepping back from that, and I do know that my concept of it as a library for kids, in the way that they used to have the Golden Library, who knows, maybe that's not exactly been like the best idea, I'm not sure, but I, for me it's an idea that I immediately gravitated towards, and it's still an idea that I think as the books pile up on a shelf will take on more weight and be seen in the context of what they're meant to be. I mean, some people will say like, well, this looks too much like a series Art Deco book or something, and I think, well, maybe an Art Deco book with a big picture of a monster on
upside down.
Any kid I've shown like those Nancy books to or something, it's like they relate instantly to that big Nancy head. Yeah. It's like they're not concerned that there's some Deco style stripes going across.
Children are very sensitive to Deco style. So it's
Can I say something about the kids' point as well? Because because I think this is something that also annoys me. I'm sorry, I'm very mad today. Because there's a lot of people who like say about the John Stanley books that these are not for kids, but that's assuming that there's something that's natural for kids, that kids have a natural taste, and it's assuming that kids have the same schlocky taste as comic book fans. So you want to give them the same schlocky material that we've been given. But actually, if you look at kids, one of the things about them is that they learn. That they're creatures that are can be educated. Yeah. They can be educated morally and also aesthetically. And if you give them like nice looking books, they will they'll learn to appreciate them. Yeah. And then you grow older with these books, and they'll gain more meaning for you over time. And that's certainly true of all the great kids' books that I read as a kid. I didn't fully appreciate them when I was first reading them, and they were like in some ways above me. But then I grew into them.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, when I think of my library of children's books on the shelf. And they're mostly from like the late 50s and 60s, the books I would have read most as a child. They're all beautiful objects.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of them are more perfunctory than others, but
they're all beautiful objects.
I know, if you think about what I grew up reading, William Steig books,
I've been saying it wrong all the time.
I'm sorry.
And Sal Buscema.
Yeah.
And Bill Sienkiewicz. I gotta go do more panels. Yeah. Steig. Oh. I'm so cosmopolitan.
Comics is working on a pronunciation guide. That'll be up
Thank
next
you.
Week.
Mowing?
And it's Jet here.
Really? All over it.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
That's why Frank
I've been pronouncing it.
He's working on a pronunciation
guide. I've been pronouncing Steranko. Dummy. I'm sorry.
I think we all grew up reading these beautiful hardcover children's books.
So why can't comics be like that? Like, why do comics have to be...
He's mad. Look out.
I don't understand.
But here's the thing. Obviously, they're not. Things are changing. My daughter now has... We have a shared comics library. Yeah. My comics are up here.
Yeah.
The shared library, they look the same. They're beautiful.
Yeah.
And my wife grew up in a house that cherished books. I did not.
Yeah.
When she moved in with me, I inherited a lot of beautiful kids' books, Grimm's fairy tales, different versions of them. And it's funny, a lot of the books we've been buying over the years, even before we had a child, were these beautiful children's books. And if that is, it's funny because just the aesthetic of having a library gets recontextualized.
Yeah.
I did not have the traditional library that you read about in children's fiction as a kid. There was a room and the parents, and again, my friend, like I said, who grew up in a household that loved books, loved the New Yorker, loved newspapers. I never had that tradition. It was daily news and television. And so I had to read Lola, whatever that thing was about. Terrible strips we had in New York. They're all muggings and things. What's that the name of it? It was just Ching Chow, and that was in the editor. That was, oh boy, ooh. Yeah. And then I moved to Staten Island where they had... You don't even want to know what's in those strips. They still have racing forms. They're reprinting Mutt and Jeff and trying to get you to buy Irish sweepstakes tickets. But, God. But, yeah, it works. It's not only just that kids learn. Kids don't give a shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they know what they know.
Yeah, exactly.
They like what they like. And they will find that one comic in the highlights that they want. They will burrow through anything. And if they see cartoon imagery or children's, or not even, they will... Read it.
Yeah.
They really will. You don't have to even plan for them as much as. And I think the library works. I never thought of it that way, but that's aiming it towards children. Sure. I mean, I was one of the people which, I wish the covers were here because I'm a geek. I want to see every piece of art in there that I can. My daughter doesn't care who John Stanley was.
Yeah.
The kids never care. When I worked on Bill and Ted's, all the fan mail went to the characters in the book, which is the most healthy thing you can have.
Yeah, sure, that's great.
In fiction, there's no cult of personality. It's about the work.
Yeah.
And that seems to be happening again, though, so calm down, man.
Okay.
Calm down.
One other thing that's not been mentioned that's pretty obvious is that in the current book market, it's important to make a book look nice and special to sell it. As things become, the world is becoming more digital, people need more reasons to purchase physical books, and that's led to a bit of a renaissance in design.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean all books have to be super fancy. I think that there's a spectrum that is actually quite appealing. I think in comics, the spectrum has been a bit skewed. And I think, like, for example, like those big, fat, essential volumes that come out of Marvel and DC, like, I think they serve a good purpose. But I don't think that, you know, and the comic fans will tend to say, like, well, you know, I just got 50 issues of Tomb of Dracula for $18. Why should I pay $18 for 3 issues of Melvin Monster? And I think it can't come down to that kind of quantity and like price count. It's not about that. There's got to be an ability to have both ends of the
spectrum. There's a certain fan, though, that you cannot...
You'll never
change. I worked in the store for 6 years, and that's when I learned that, that's why I did Eltingville, I guess. You cannot argue with them, or else you'll be running around like a Planet of the Apes extra.
Yeah.
The thing that drives me up a wall is actually the opposite. It's the person who will look at a comic book and practically sneer at it I was working in retail, or see my friend who runs a shop, is, why should I pay this much for a comic book? And if I get into this conversation with someone, I said, do you ever buy children's books?
Yeah.
You're getting much less art and story. That's not knocking it, but it amazes me that somebody will go into a Barnes & Noble, pay $20, $16 for a very thin volume, sometimes for a book that a kid will eat rather than read, and they think that's a fine purchase or gift or for the child. $14, $15, $16 for a thick book of children's comics. Somehow,
of course,
that's...
we're coming from a tradition where the work was originally sold for a dime.
Yeah,
and that,
sure,
that
but
has not really left people's minds.
No.
Yeah, no.
That drives me crazy.
That's still the model people have at the back of their head.
Yeah.
I want to.
It's hard to put.
We're running out of time, but I want to touch on one more thing, which is that one thing we haven't talked about, and that
is love.
Is love. God, we all love each other.
I love everyone on this table.
G, we love you.
Yeah, we love you.
No, but there's something to be said about the ethics and business of this, which is that, you know, in the case of John Stanley books or whatever the book is, even my books, Art and Time, which is that people... Evan's writing me a note. Which is that, you know, for example, there was the Mocha show that I got all pissy about because artists weren't being credited.
Yeah. You hate comics, man.
It's because I hate comics.
That was amazing.
And but there is still a tremendous gap in not on the part of Fantagraphics and Toronto Quarterly, I don't think, but perhaps more in mainstream comics, between sort of fair attribution to artists, fair payment to the estates if there is an estate.
Yeah.
Or if they want the money, or if they're able to be found. You know, there's a lot of... it's very, very thorny stuff, in effect, because these artists were not well compensated, they were not credited. Yeah. And so how do you kind of... how do we think about honoring them, both aesthetically, of course, by bringing their work back into print, and historically, but also on a sort of financial and credit level? Obviously, Marvel or... Dark Horse more recently is, whatever you think of his work, you know, Barry Windsor Smith has been outraged by the recoloring of his work, which to me is just unethical. Digital recoloring
without his permission.
Without his permission.
I didn't know that.
I mean, it's interesting because, like, Marvel, I think DC is a little bit different, but Marvel has published so much Jack Kirby over the last, like, few years, and not 1 cent from any of those books goes to the Kirby estate. I think they were giving a little bit of money when Kirby's widow was alive, but and in the last few years, not 1 cent. I think that is the norm.
I didn't know that either. I thought they were still...
No.
I thought the kids were getting...
So I think that... I mean, and this grows out of a long history of mistreating artists. We have to think about that. There's an ethical dimension to all this.
Yeah. I think we'll have to leave it with Jade, it looks like.
Yeah, sorry.
I think we have to wrap it up. Unless, Evan, do you want... You look like you're about to say something.
No, that's bullshit. I mean, they're doing a better job of crediting everybody. Yeah. And digging out.
Yeah. They have.
Inger as an assistant. I mean, you know, the idea that Roz is now getting credit as an Inger on things, I always thought was fantastic.
Yeah.
It's also a little bit of history I didn't know, but that's ridiculous. I mean, a few weeks ago, I Twittered. I put a tweet up that said, I wonder how much money everybody's making on Jack Kirby today. Not just at Marvel, the artist. I mean, I've done it.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, that's a real big subject.
We can't tackle that. Two small points.
One is that I think in the talk of repackaging artists and the idea of desecrating their work, it must be remembered that the entire history of comics has been other people working with other people's characters.
Yeah.
And nobody has had a problem with that.
Yeah.
It's like Jack Kirby's work is being redrawn every single day by 100 cartoonists, and nobody's complaining, but I draw a picture of Melvin Monster and they're upset. Secondly,
well, you get the costume wrong all the time.
Yeah.
You're always moving the time machine parts to here.
I think the second point is what was it?
Sorry.
No, that's okay. I was going to say, the second thing is I think fans have to remember that their associations and love of certain characters shouldn't supersede their love of the artist who created the work, and that they should keep their concerns about whether, you know, what's their investment in the characters isn't as important as the artist's career, the body of their work.
That's the aggrieved proprietary stance.
Yeah.
This is the people who are mad at the Siegel and Schuster heirs for suing for their characters that they created because they might interrupt the flow of their comic books. They think that they're bad eggs who are just getting in the way of fans. And
God knows there hasn't been enough Superman comics.
Well, you know, not even knocking that, but I mean, how could you just be such an asshole?
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? Do you think they're going to stop making fill in the blank? I mean, Ziggy's going to come out forever. So is Superman.
Yeah.
Corpses will rise out of the earth and keep drawing all of these characters. You know what I mean? But to see people, Spurgeon writes about that, I think, very eloquently, that it's disgusting to see people say, the Kirby kids are greedy schmucks who are going to interrupt my fun. And that's what they're saying. Yeah. It's disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah, really. Read go to a movie.
Well, that's it.